Good morning. I'd like to talk for a few moments about some examples of strong women in the Bible. And I think that this lesson is timely maybe for a couple of reasons. First of all, it's almost Mother's Day, not quite Mother's Day. It's a time where naturally we think about strong women in our own lives. But I think also, you know, particularly with things coming out in the news about, you know, the Me Too movement, oppression of women in various aspects of our culture, I think that a lot of times it gives occasion for people to get the wrong idea of how women and women role of women are portrayed in the Bible. And what you frequently kind of hear people react to are passages like 1 Timothy 2 and verse 11. Let a woman learn quietly with all submissiveness. I do not permit a woman to teach or exercise authority over man. Rather, she is to remain quiet. For Adam was formed first, then Eve. It was Adam who's deceived. Adam was not deceived, but the woman was deceived and became a transgressor. And it goes on, but this is the passage that people are left with. And of course, this passage exists. Paul is writing to Timothy with specific instructions for how they're supposed to behave in the amongst the brethren and in the church. But it leaves kind of the world with a taste that the Bible view of the woman is the silent woman in that sits in services. And I don't think that's a very accurate picture. And so what I want to look at are several women that we find in the Bible and show you exactly what a godly woman is from that point of view. And I hope that that will be of benefit to you, especially to our young ladies in the audience. So the first one that I want to look at is Jochebed, which you may not even know who Jochebed is, although the picture hopefully gives a little bit away, and that is the mother of Moses. And for that, we turn to Exodus, the first chapter. She's not mentioned by name in Exodus 1. She's mentioned elsewhere here. But let's remind ourselves, really, of the situation that Jochebed found herself in. You remember that the end of Genesis is where Joseph is still in control of all of Egypt, and the people of Israel come there and dwell there. And verse 8 of Exodus 1 says, "Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, 'Behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply and, if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land.'" Imagine a people's, we have a lot of immigrants in the United States. Imagine the immigrants get so mighty in number that there's concern that there's more immigrants than Americans. That might be some of the fear of some people in our government right now. That's the situation Pharaoh's in. So, verse 11, they took taskmasters set over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. They built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom, Ramses, and it goes on and on and on. But that's not the only thing Pharaoh does. In verse 15, it says, "The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah, and the other was Puah, 'When you serve as midwife to the Hebrew women, you shall set them on, and you see them on the birth stool. If it's a son, you shall kill him. But if it's a daughter, she shall live.' But the midwives feared God, and they did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but let the male children live." So maybe I should add some room over here, right, for these very brave midwives who stood up and did not do what the king commanded because they feared God, right, and not men. But of course, Pharaoh does not stop there. He extends, it's not just now a commandment to the midwives. If you drop down to verse 22, Pharaoh commanded all his people, "Every son that's born to the Hebrews you shall cast in the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live." Makes it much harder to hide, right? If every Egyptian now has the mandate to cast every Hebrew male child into the river Nile. And so that's the scene which is set when we meet Moses' parents, who in this text remain nameless. Verse 1 of chapter 2, "A man from the house of Levi went and took as his wife a Levite woman. The woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months." And so immediately you can commiserate with Jochebed, who has this beautiful child. I can't imagine any mother ever not thinking that her child was beautiful. And she just cannot throw him into the river, and so she does what, you know, we would imagine maybe many mothers do, and she hid him for 3 months. But of course, that's short-lived. You can't hide a child for that long. It's going to become obvious very soon. Verse 3, When she could hide him no longer, she took for him a basket made of bulrushes and daubed it with bitumen and pitch, and she put the child in it and placed it among the reeds by the riverbank. So, I mean, I don't know if you've had this experience, but have you ever gone and maybe played by the creek and built little boats out of leaves and sticks and things? And, you know, like maybe you have a little toy. This is what I did as a child. Maybe that people don't do that anymore. But, I mean, I would never think about putting a real person, let alone a three-month-old child, in a boat that I made myself. But that's what his mother did, right? And it was because she just couldn't bear to see him die. And in some sense, she is obeying the law of the land. She did put him in the Nile, right? But just also in a boat. But Jochebed is not the only person to be praised here. At least this picture here depicts two children on, and this is from, you know, from a movie depiction a number of years ago. But presumably this is Miriam and Aaron, right? The siblings of Moses. And this unnamed sister, which presumably is Miriam, is talked about in verse 4. His sister stood at a distance to know what would be done to him. Tremendous, we should put Miriam's name up there as well. Verse 5, now the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river while her young women walked beside the river. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her servant woman, and she took it. And when she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the baby was crying. She took pity on him and said, this is one of the Hebrews' children. But then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and call a nurse from the Hebrew women to nurse the child for you? How handy that Moses' sister just happened to be there, right, as the baby was discovered. Pharaoh's daughter said, go. So the girl called the child's mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, take the child away, nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages. So not only does his mother actually nurse him, but she's paid to nurse her own child. And when the child grew up, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son, and she named him Moses, because I drew him out of the water. I think on a number of levels, Jochebed is a very heroic figure and a strong woman whose faith was put to the test. And although her name is not mentioned specifically, she is amongst the heroes that we read about in Hebrews, the 11th chapter, the heroes of faith, when it speaks about Moses in verse 23. He says, by faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents because they saw the child was beautiful and they were not afraid of the king's edict. Hebrews praises her for her act of faith. Another strong woman that I think about when I think on these examples is Hannah. And Hannah, we read about in Samuel, 1 Samuel, the first chapter, right? And of course, if your memory is a little rusty, Hannah, of course, is the mother of the eventual Samuel, whose book this is. So it's maybe his origin story, if you will. But there in verse 1, we find out that Hannah is married to this guy named Elkanah. And verse 2 says he had two wives. This never goes well. If you're reading in the Bible that he has two wives, it just doesn't go well, right? Anyway, the name of the one was Hannah. The name of the other, Penaniah. And Penaniah had children, but Hannah had no children. You knew it was coming, right? Even if you didn't know the story, right? That seems to be always the way it ends up. Verse 3, now this man used to go up year by year from his city to worship and sacrifice to the Lord of hosts at Shiloh. Jerusalem doesn't even exist yet. Well, not like the Jerusalem as we know it. It does not exist. The temple does not exist. And so Shiloh is the holy place where they go to worship. And at Shiloh is where the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were priests of the Lord. And on the day when Elkanah sacrificed, he would give portions to Penaniah, his wife, and to all her sons and daughters. But to Hannah, he gave a double portion because he loved her, though the Lord had closed her womb. And so what we see here is a good husband, right? Realizing that his wife would feel not very blessed. Childbirth was, I mean, even today, the ability to bear children, right, is a sign of a blessing and fertility. But even more so in their society, like the value of women was tightly tied to their ability to give birth. And so here we see, you know, that Hannah at least is not despised by her husband and even given a double portion of whatever it was that he was handing it out. But verse 6 kind of sets up the problem. Her rival used to provoke her grievously, to irritate her, because the Lord had closed her womb. And so we see this other woman, the language there is very strong. Verse 7, so it went on year by year. This wasn't once or twice. This is something that they constantly did, and it happened year after year after year. As often as she went up to the house of the Lord, she used to provoke her. Therefore, Hannah wept and would not eat. And Elkanah said, her husband said to her, Hannah, why do you weep? And why do you not eat? And why is your heart sad? Am I not more to you than 10 sons? Oh, you deluded male. Yeah, right. this really speaks to just how desperately she really wants this child. She's not, I like food. I like food a lot. And she is so upset about this that, you know, she is inconsolable. So what does she do? Verse 9. After they had eaten and drunk in Shiloh, Hannah rose. Now, Eli the priest was sitting on the seat beside the doorpost of the temple of the Lord. Verse 10. She was deeply distressed and prayed to the Lord and wept bitterly. And she vowed a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your servant and remember me not, and not forget your servant, but will give to your servant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall touch his head. A strong vow. Right? But I really think that description of her vow doesn't do her justice, right? Because of the way that what Eli the priest interprets what she's doing. Keep reading. Verse 12. She continued to pray before the Lord. Eli observed her mouth. Right? And Hannah was speaking in her heart. Only her lips moved. Her voice was not heard, which I'm given to understand was very strange for the ancients. They wouldn't have done these types of things. And therefore Eli took her to be a drunken woman. And Eli said to her, how long will you go on being drunk? Put your wine away from you. I mean, like, she is so distraught and distressed over this, and her prayer is so, I don't know what other words to put to it, that Eli interprets that she's in fact drunk. But she says, no, my Lord, I'm not drunk. Verse 15, I am a woman troubled in spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but I've been pouring out my soul before the Lord. Do not regard your servant as a worthless woman. For all along I've been speaking out of my anxiety and vexation. And Eli said, go in peace. The God of Israel grant your petition that you have made to him. And she said, let your servant find favor in your eyes. Then the woman went her way and ate, and her face was no longer sad. So I think there are a couple things in this text about Hannah that really stand out to me. First of all, there is no indication that Hannah responded in kind ever. This woman lashes out at her. She's deeply grieved, but there's nothing in the text to suggest that she fought back, right, or stooped to her rival's level. And the second thing is that whenever she really was distressed, she ran towards the Lord and took it to the Lord in prayer. And then it says, she went her way, she ate again, and her face was no longer sad. She left it to the Lord and was able to step back from it in full confidence, right, that the Lord would take care of it. And that you can see that in her behavior. And I think that this is admirable on her part. And so there in the verses that follow, that she and her husband are able to conceive. She does give birth to a son. And then in verse 21, we see the man Elkanah and all of his house went up to offer the Lord the yearly sacrifice and to pay his vow. Back to business as usual. But Hannah did not go. Right? You might think, oh, she's going to try to keep the child. No. It says, Hannah did not go, for she said to her husband, as soon as the child is weaned, I will bring him, so that he may appear in the presence of the Lord and dwell there forever. It's crystal clear in Hannah's mind. I made this vow as I'm not going to go with you now, because as soon as a child is weaned, I'm going and I'm giving my child to the Lord. And I think that that is truly a heroic character and a strong woman for us to emulate. Well, the first two examples were, I think, rather maternal. A lot of, you know, what we think about and that kind of deep love for children we see echoed in Jochebed and Hannah. And the next two are not. When I think of strong women in the Bible, I think a lot about Deborah. And we find the stories about her in the book of Judges. Turn back a few pages to Judges, the fourth chapter. And now, in the period of the Judges, you'll remember this is the time when, according to the text of Judges, there was no king in Israel, and everybody did what was right in their own eyes. And this is the cycle that we often talk about, that Judges outlines for us, that, you know, the people were evil, and God rose up somebody to persecute them, and then they cried out for a Savior, and then God rose that Savior who delivered them, and then they had some peace for a while. Well, they're stuck in this cycle, and at this point, it's a mean, nasty guy named Sisera who is tormenting them. You can read about that in those first few verses. But what we find here is we find that Deborah is out trying to call the people, you know, back to a true worship of God. Let's look at verse 4. Deborah was a prophetess. First and foremost, the Bible describes her as a prophetess, not a fortune teller. She was one that was, like many of the prophets that we read about, calling the people to a true worship of God, calling the people back to where they came from. It says that she was the wife of Lippidoth, who was judging Israel at that time, and she used to sit under the palm of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim. And the people of Israel came up to her for judgment. So she was so well known for doing this that they named a tree after her. It must have been some big, well-known palm, because it's called the Palm of Deborah, which I think reflects that, you know, it was well-known, and when the people needed to go for her and needed to know something of the Lord, they went there, or needed somebody to discern a matter, they went there. Verse 6, she sent and summoned Barak, the son of Abinoam from Kadesh Naphtali, and said to him, okay, so remember, she's calling Barak, not Barak calling her, or calling upon her. Has not the Lord, the God of Israel, commanded you, go gather your men at Mount Tabor, taking 10,000 from the people of Naphtali and the people of Zebulun, and I will draw out Sisera, the general of Jabin's army, to meet you by the river Kishon with his chariots and his troops, and I will give them into your hand. So, did you catch that? So Deborah has to contact Barak and say, hey, hasn't God told you to do something about this Sisera guy, right? So, which is a little embarrassing on the part of Barak, right? So apparently God had appeared to Barak or had sent him a message or a dream of some sort and told him, you need to do this, and he wasn't doing it, and Deborah actually calls upon him and calls him to do the thing that God had told him to do. Apparently it was revealed to her that that was what was told him. So how does Barak respond? Probably now, like, he stands up valiantly and will now, like many Bible heroes we know and love, like, okay, yes, now I just needed that little push. I'm going to defend. No, that's not what he does. Verse 8. Barak said to her, if you will go with me, I will go. Wow, impressive, right? If you will go, I will go. Not a very fearless person, not a very person who much of a person who trusts in God. He says, if you will go with me, I will go, but if you will not go, I will not go. And she said, I will surely go with you. Nevertheless, the road on which you are going will not lead to your glory, for the Lord will sell Sisera into the hand of a woman. And then Deborah rose and went with Barak to Kedesh, and Barak called out Zebulun and Naphtali to Kedesh, and 10,000 men went up at his heels, and Deborah went up with him. So impressive, right? Spoiler alert, a lot of the interactions of men and women in the Bible look very bad for the men. This one does, and the next one does too, which I think tells us something as well. But I'll leave it to you to figure out what that tells you. So this is going to happen, and in fact, in the verses that follow, we see the battle take place. Deborah is there, and part of that. And Sisera manages to kind of break away and flee. And let's drop down to verse 17, because Deborah is not the only woman of note in this story. But Sisera fled away on foot to the tent of Jael, wife of Heber the Kenite, for there was peace between Jabin the king of Hazor and the house of Heber the Kenite. And Jael came out to meet Sisera and said, "Turn aside, my lord. Turn aside to me. Do not be afraid." Just pause for a moment. If anybody tells you, you know, "Come on in, don't be afraid," that is, you know, your spidey senses should tingle. Like, that is danger, right? And it's true in this case as well. So he turned aside into her tent, and she covered him with a rug. I think the implication there is she was hiding him. I mean, a tent is not exactly a great place to hide, so she's hiding him so that he will not be discovered. Verse 19, and he said to her, "Please give me a little water to drink, for I'm thirsty." Sounds reasonable. So she opened a skin of milk and gave her to drink and covered him. Now, I don't know, you know, what you think of when you think of warm milk, because there was no refrigeration, right? So it had to be warm milk. But isn't that what you give kids when you want them to go to sleep? Right. Well, and he said to her, "Stand at the opening of the tent, and if any man comes and asks you, 'Is anyone here?' say, 'No.'" But Jael, the wife of Heber, took a tent peg and took a hammer in her hand, and she went softly to him and drove the peg in his temple until it went down to the ground while he was lying fast asleep from weariness, and so he died. Now, young ladies, I do think there is a lesson here to be learned about strong and powerful women, but I'm not suggesting that you pick up a tent peg to your brother's head. That would be bad and wrong. But we see in this story, you know, that these strong women were willing to do the things that, you know, the men were fearful of doing, even when the Lord had told them to do those things. To such an extent, really, that it's represented in song. If you look at the whole of chapter 5 is an entire song about this whole event. And I want to point out a couple of places in it. If you look in chapter 5, starting in verse 6, it describes, well, what was Israel like at this time? What was kind of going on there? It says there, "In the days of Shamgar, the son of Anath, in the days of Jael, the highways were abandoned, and travelers kept to the byways." Nobody's on the main roads. They were abandoned. They weren't safe, right? You could be killed and attacked because it was not a safe place to be. Verse 7, "The villagers ceased in Israel. They ceased to be until I arose. I, Deborah, arose as mother in Israel." And it kind of paints the picture that life as they knew it had come to a standstill because nobody would rise and deliver the people from Sisera and from the Canaanite armies. Right? And Deborah steps in and leads her community and fulfills that role. And also, if you drop down, Jael's deeds are also sung of in verse 24. The song calls her, "Most blessed of women be Jael." Calls her the most blessed of women, the wife of Heber the Kenite, of tent-dwelling women most blessed. In case you think that you know all girls' deeds have to be, you know, what's it called, sweet and spice and everything nice. Look at what is represented about Jael. "He asked water, she gave him milk. She brought him curds in a noble's bowl. She set her hand to the tent peg and her right hand to the workman's mallet. She struck Sisera. She crushed his head. She shattered and pierced his temple. Between her feet, he sank. He fell. He lay still. Between her feet, he sank. He fell. Where he sank, there he fell. Dead." This is what is remembered of Jael. Powerful. A very powerful language encased in this song, right, to remember for all generations. So certainly not all the examples that we find in the Bible of strong women have that maternal aspect. There are great women doing a lot of things in the Bible, including leading people. And the last one that I want to talk about this morning, we find in Samuel, and that is Abigail. So in 1 Samuel, the 25th chapter, we read about Abigail. And this is a moment in David's life where he's been anointed king, but he's not yet king. And Saul is chasing him around, and he has like a band of men with him, kind of like Robin Hood. In fact, many believe that the story of David and his men was the inspiration for the modern myth, or the much later myth of Robin Hood. That he went around with his merry band of men and delivered the people from their enemies. And so while Saul is pursuing him and trying to kill him, David is going around and protecting the people from the neighboring nations, from the Philistines, from the others that would do them harm. Truly remarkable guy. And he shows tremendous restraint, even in chapter 24, is one of the instances where David spares Saul's life. It seems like he's got him right in his hand, but he in fact spares him. And in this instance, we find in chapter 25, we find him coming upon a man, Nabal. And we'll start like at the end of in verse 2. There was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel. The man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep, 1,000 goats. He was shearing his sheep in Carmel. Now the name of the man was Nabal, and the name of his wife, Abigail. The woman was discerning and beautiful, but the man was harsh and badly behaved. And he was a Calebite. I'm not sure if the Calebite is meant to be like, he was badly behaved, he was a Calebite. I don't think so. He descended from Caleb, one of the two spies, right, that were allowed into the land. David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep, and so David sent 10 young men, and David said to the young men, go up to Carmel and go to Nabal and greet him in my name, and thus you shall greet him. Peace be to you, peace be to your house, peace be to all that you have. I hear you have shearers. Now your shepherds have been with us, and we did them no harm. They missed nothing in all the time they were in Carmel. Ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we come on a feast day. Please give whatever you have at hand to your servants and to your son, David. And so the picture that we see here is that David has done a lot to protect Nabal and his shepherds. And now, you know, we're going to find out in a minute, David has 600 men with him. And he needs something back from Nabal. He needs him to take care of them and give them provisions. And of course, Nabal does not react well to this, verse 10. Nabal answered David's servants, who's David? Who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants these days who are breaking away from their masters. Shall I take my bread and my water and my meat that I've killed for my shears and give it to the men who come from I do not know where? And so David's young men turned away, came back and told him all this. David said to his men, every man strap on his sword, and every man of them strapped on his sword. David also strapped on his sword, and about 400 men went up after David, while 200 remained with the baggage. So Nabal behaves very badly, right? Says, David, who is this David guy? And, you know, unwilling to recognize and appreciate the benefit that he had received from that same David. In fact, later we read in verse 21, now David had said, surely in vain I've guarded all that this fellow has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belonged to him, and he's returned me evil for good. God do so to the enemies of David, and more also if by morning I leave so much as one male of all who belong to him. Interesting, right? Now the man was married to Abigail, and Abigail has caught wind of how Nabal is answering these young men. And what we find is she's quick to action. So we read here in verse 18. It says, Abigail made haste and took 200 loaves, 2 skins of wine, 5 sheep already prepared, and 5 seahs of parched grain, and 100 clusters of raisins, and 200 cakes of figs, and laid them on donkeys. And she said to her young men, go on before me. Behold, I come after you. But she did not tell her husband, Nabal. So we see Abigail perceives what a slight this is to David and is quick to take action. And Nabal is currently drunk in this story. Again, it doesn't speak very favorably from him. And when she comes to him in verse 23, it says, she hurried and got down from the donkey and fell before David on her face and bowed to the ground. She fell at his feet and said, on me alone, my lord, be the guilt. Please let your servant speak in your ears and hear the words of your servant. Let not my lord regard this worthless fellow Nabal for his name. For as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name and folly is with him. That's what Nabal means, folly. What a bad thing to name your child. But anyway, Nabal is his name and folly is with him. And she goes on to talk about all that she has done to counteract this deal that Nabal has made, and David spares her. In fact, David is incredibly grateful. He says down in verse 32, blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who sent you this day to meet me. Blessed be your discretion, and blessed be you who have kept me this day from blood guilt and from avenging myself with my own hand. So we see Abigail really prevented David, a very measured man. The previous chapter, he was able to keep himself from killing his mortal enemy who was trying to kill him, right? And yet, in this, he loses his cool, being disrespected by the very people he was protecting, and it takes Abigail to counteract that. Her husband dies at the end of this. When he hears about what happened, it says his heart turns to stone, and 10 days later he dies. And then David takes her to be his wife. Well, the Bible tells of many, many others. Actually, as I was kind of going through it, it was hard to pick. You could talk about Sarah. You could talk about Hagar, Rebecca, Leah, Rahab. Rahab's story is amazing. She ends up in Jesus' lineage. Naomi and Ruth. There is like a whole book dedicated about a beautiful and powerful woman. Esther as well. Elizabeth, which is John the Baptist's mother, and Mary, Jesus' mother. Think of how hard, I don't think we often focus on Mary so much, probably because the Catholic Church focuses so much on her. But what a difficult thing it would have been to live the mother of a presumably illegitimate child. And then also to kind of deal with what it was like to be the vessel through which God in human flesh came through. I mean, that it had to be a challenge for her in many ways. Anna, the prophetess, Mary Magdalene, Lydia owned her own business. She was a seller of purple. Priscilla, we mentioned today in the reading, and even Dorcas, who's mentioned for her hospitality and care for the saints. There are many, many examples of very strong women in the Bible, and many who are mentioned but not specifically named. And I think that the complete picture really shows that godly women, yes, they care for their families, as we so frequently, that's what comes to mind most easily and perhaps is the most natural in our culture for the past several decades. But, we also see they devoted their children to God. They led their communities. They stood fearless against enemies. They took initiative and avoid disasters, not just for them, but on those around them. They used their influence for good. They operated businesses. They used the proceeds to spread the gospel. They served. They taught God's people. You see a very broad picture. And as we train our young women, I think we need to be careful of not giving them too narrow a perspective of what a godly woman is. And not just our young women. I think we also owe it to the world, right, to represent more accurately the role and the function of a godly woman as portrayed in the Bible. So I hope that you found that helpful. I hope that you found that encouraging. I was encouraged to think about these strong women and their stories. We always make an invitation at our meetings. If you are not a Christian, want to become one, we urge you to become one. If you are a Christian and need the prayers of the saints, then we ask that you come down now and make those needs known while we stand and while we sing.